From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Argo Studios in New York City. It's the first weekend of spring, and here in the Northeast, things are heating up, both temperature-wise and politically also. The temperature of the rhetoric keeps rising.
We do well among people who take their faith seriously. And
oh, dear. As if the religious test for candidates that seems to be creeping into this electoral cycle weren't enough of a perversion of our political process already. Now, candidate Rick Santorum is all but saying that supporting him is a test of the validity of a voter's religious authenticity. I'll have something to say about that, as you would expect, just a little later in the show. Many of us have watched the GOP primary campaign unfold with growing concern about the prevalence of religious language in it, and we've worried that permanent damage to the separation of church and state, as enshrined in the Constitution, would result. A refreshingly different take on these events appeared on the website Patheos, and the author, Christian Pyatt, will explain later on this edition of State of Belief Radio.
We really wanted to demolish the idea that Muslim women are submissive and lack agency and control over their lives.
A few weeks ago, I began reading a new book, Love, Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. This is one of those books that makes you think about people with whom you'd like to share it. Well, you are among those people with whom I want to share it when the author Noura Masnavi joins us on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
have you heard of the All-American Prophet? The blonde-haired, blue-eyed voice of God. He didn't come from the Middle East.
Robert V. Agus is founder of Playbill.com and author, co-author or editor of 16 books on the performing arts. Robert, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Faith-themed shows are currently on the boards.
Yeah, there's a couple.
What would you name as faith-based shows right now?
Well, I don't know if they're faith-based, but there are shows that touch on religion. Of course, they're the very obvious. Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell are playing simultaneously. Interestingly, when they ran originally in the early 70s, they were also both on at the same time. There's also Book of Mormon. A lot of people debate whether it makes fun of Mormonism, which it sort of does. But one thing that's interesting, it also has a Jesus appears as a character in that. So there are three Broadway shows currently that have Jesus as a character in them. So I guess that's something. It's the second, third, and fourth coming, I guess it counts as.
But is that an unusually high number?
That is an unusually high number, yes, of Son of God on Broadway, yes. But there's also shows that deal overtly or in other ways with religion. There's Leap of Faith, which is it's about a sort of a religious charlatan. The plot is actually very similar to The Music Man, except, of course, instead of selling boys' bands, he's selling salvation. And then there's Sister Act, which is based on the film about somebody on the run from a killer who hides out in a convent. But there are a number of shows on Broadway and off that touch on, let's say, religious themes.
And Jesus is in right now.
Apparently so. But the bottom line is a lot of people who attend the theater are visitors to New York. And a lot of the visitors tend to come from other parts of the country. And, of course, they want to come in and they want to see a successful show. But they want to see something that they could take their kids to, something that maybe they will feel comfortable. And they will look at a list of things and they'll say, well, I don't know about that. I don't know about that. But this is about nuns. It's not The Sound of Music, but Sister Act is about nuns. How bad can it be? So I think that also has something to do with it. I think there's an economic reason. I think that they know that this is something that could potentially appeal to a large portion of the audience.
Are you surprised by what's happened with the Book of Mormon, the great success of it?
There's a lot of different reasons why Book of Mormon is so successful. Number one, of course, is it's very funny. Have you seen Book of Mormon?
I've not been able to because at the last – the cheapest ticket I could find was $375.
Well, the title is kind of misleading. A lot of people say it's Book of Mormon. They think it's about the Book of Mormon, not unreasonably. But in fact, Book of Mormon, it's a little joke contained in there. The main character, Elder Cunningham, who's been sent to Kenya to proselytize and convert people to Mormonism, what he hasn't let on is the fact that he's never actually read the Book of Mormon. He's picked up little bits and pieces of Mormonism, but his terrible secret is he's never read it. And so when he gets there and he actually tries to convert people from the actual Book of Mormon, they are not interested. That doesn't appeal to them. And he's kind of shocked by the things that he finds in it too. So he makes up his own religion, cobbling together pieces of Mormonism plus Lord of the Rings and Star Wars and things that he has seen in his life. And this new religion, the quote-unquote Book of Mormon, which is really the Book of Elder Cunningham, proves to be enormously popular with the people in Kenya. But it kind of shocks the people back in Salt Lake City, as the song goes. But I think people are curious about it. Certainly there is a man now who could very well become not only the Republican nominee for president, but who could become president, who is a Mormon. And I think people are very curious about things like that. Anything that has a lot of power over our lives – and religion often does have a lot of power over our lives, becomes of tremendous interest to people. They want to understand things that have power over their lives. And sometimes if they're frightened of it, in comes humor, because humor is a way of diffusing the threat from things that scare us.
Most of the shows that we've talked about have to do with Western religions, Christianity obviously being the most prominent one. But we are beginning to get cultures and ideas in shows that go beyond Christianity to the other great world religions. Do you see that as well?
Well, you know, there's been a number of shows over the years that have tried to deal with some of these things. It's difficult to deal with Islam directly because they forbid the portraying of Muhammad, the prophet. Although, you know, at the turn of the century, 100 years ago, you were not allowed on the stage to portray any divine personage. In London, it was completely banned. You couldn't get a play approved. If you actually like Jesus Christ Superstar wouldn't have been able to be performed because it's a divine person, and it was banned from the stage. So, but there have been plays. There was a play that was done in Chicago called Disgraced, which was about a Muslim American lawyer. There was a play with the odd title, Forgiving John Lennon, very contemporary theme. It was about a college radio station that, as a prank, says that Muslims now all have to wear identifying garb. It's not so much about the fact that they do that. It's the enormous backlash from that that forms the drama of the play. But there was an interesting play on Broadway in 2004. It was called 16 Wounded. I don't know if you remember.
I saw it.
You saw it.
I saw it.
And it tried to deal with – it was about a baker in Holland, I believe, who hired – Jewish baker who hired a Palestinian young man as his assistant and hoping to try to create some sort of understanding, hoping to try to create some sort of rapprochement. And in fact, it just becomes more and more inflamed, and it's kind of the story of what happens as a result of that. And it ran a very short time. It ran about 2 weeks. And I remember the producer, Rocco Landisman, saying to me, you know, out of all the many, many things that I've produced – and he produced a lot. He produced The Producers, as a matter of fact, on Broadway. He said, I don't understand why that play did not go over better than it did. And I said, I thought it tried to create – it tried to treat the Palestinians and the Israelis as basically morally equal.
Right.
And I don't think audiences could accept them as morally equal. I think they felt that there was one – no matter what side you came from, you felt that one side had more legitimacy than the other side. And so unfortunately, a drama that dealt very, very in an adult way, in a very thoughtful way with this issue did not last, unfortunately.
Do you see the possibility of Broadway stage contributing to some healing in the great divides of our nation?
It would be very easy to say no. But I think that a lot of things that once they reach Broadway, there is a level of acceptance and a level of mainstreaming that once something is dealt with there, it's sort of accepted in the mainstream. Now, you have to remember, when Jesus Christ Superstar opened, there were pickets in front of the theater. There were people marched against it, and it was just an outrage that Jesus would be involved with rock music. And now, I mean, there are churches that have pop music services. It has become much more accepted. And the fact that they're reviving Jesus, it's like reviving Guys and Dolls. It's another classic musical that's being revived. You don't have that gnashing of teeth and rending of garments that you had when it opened originally. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a certain amount of mainstreaming that comes about when you see a show on Broadway, and it kind of becomes acceptable for a wider culture. There have been, you know, many things down through the years where Broadway was the first. Even something like Chorus Line, it's kind of sad now. You see revivals of Chorus Line, and when they deal with the gay issue in Chorus Line, for example, people are like, oh, another gay character, because it's become so widely accepted in the culture. But trust me, when they came out and said, I'm gay, very openly in that show in 1975, it was startling. When Paul gives his jewel box speech, Paul is one of the characters, and he tells the story of how he was in this drag review. It was riveting. It was really, really transgressive to talk about those things. I think that even the fact that there's a musical on Broadway about Mormonism has taken some of the sting out of Mormonism, although I think Mormonism deserves a closer look. I think that the guys who wrote Book of Mormon find Mormonism hilarious because it is really such an American-born religion. It didn't come from the Middle East. It's pure Americana, and it has all the pluses and minuses that go along with that.
Robert, talk about the beginning of theater and how it's not inappropriate for religious leaders and theater leaders to be in dialogue with each other.
Theater began as religion. It began as religious ceremony. The mass today is very theatrical. They've maintained that. I mean, if you go way, way back, religious ceremonies tended to have theatrical elements to them. Even 3,000 years ago in Egypt, they would create miracles on stage. A lot of the early theater was the stories from the Bible. So there's always been a religious dimension to what we do on the stage, and dealing with, I mean, the religious epics in the 20s, they were a staple. I mean, we talked about a Superstar and mm-hmm. Godspell. Don't forget, the guys who wrote that wrote other plays. The Bible has been very good to both of them. Stephen Schwartz, who wrote Godspell, also wrote Children of Eden, which is about about Genesis, based on Genesis. Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice wrote Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, going back there to the Old Testament. They got both Testaments working for them, singing for them.
Yeah. Robert V. Agus is founder of Playbill.com and author, co-author, or editor of 16 books on the performing arts, notably the Playbill Broadway Yearbook Series, which he also founded. Robert is the current executive editor of Playbill EDU, a new website for drama, dance, and theater higher education. His latest book, published this month, available now, is Scales to Scalpels, about a Boston Symphony Orchestra consisting entirely of active professional doctors and surgeons. Robert, I have enjoyed this so much.
Thanks for having me.
We've got to take a break, but there's a lot more still ahead today. We'll talk to Christian Piatt on why the current prevalence of religious rhetoric in our politics may just be good for church-state separation in the long run. And up next, Noura Masnavi, whose provocative new book is titled Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Relatable far beyond a particular culture, faith, or gender, a new book entitled Love Inshallah The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women, answers questions that you may or may not have thought to ask. But just as much, it can inspire asking similar questions about the particular conventions the reader may have always taken for granted. I am very happy to have the author Noura Masnavi join me now on State of Belief Radio. Noura, welcome to State of Belief.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Something you wrote recently at the Huffington Post seems to offer a great introduction to this conversation. You said everyone has an opinion about Muslim women, even those, especially those who've never met one. Is that why you wrote the book?
Yeah, my co-editor Aisha Matu and I, we were talking about 5 years ago about how there's so much that's been written about Muslim women, but very little of that has actually been written by Muslim women ourselves. And nowhere in the sort of discourse about Muslim women did we see ourselves reflected, the lives of our family or friends or the Muslim women we know. So we really wanted to sort of take control of that narrative and start telling our stories.
One of the first questions that came to my mind, where is the authority for moral action in Islam? Is it in the Quran? Is it in the imam? Is it in the individual conscience?
That's a great question. And, you know, within Islam, there are a number of different traditions, interpretations. We believe that the Quran is the word of God. The Quran is the holy book for Muslims. Mm-hmm. And we also look to the life of the Prophet Muhammad and the way he lived his life and interacted with people and his traditions, his sayings. But what we were dealing with in this book, which I think is very interesting, is sort of the lived reality of Muslim women in America. So we know what sort of the prescriptions are, and that really depends on your type of practice, but what does Islam look like as a lived reality? And I think that this is why this book has really struck a chord with so many people, is that it kind of shows the way in which American Muslim women are negotiating all the complexities of their religion and their identities.
Mm-hmm. So in reading the book, should we assume that just as there are diverse authors in the book, each of these people may be looking at a different set of standards? It's not that all of them are measuring their relationship by one standard?
Yeah, for Aisha and I, we really realized as Muslim women that there are, we're dealing with the Muslim community in America is really the most diverse Muslim community in the world. Mm-hmm. We have people who, with their families sort of traced back to the founding of our country. We have women who are the daughters of immigrants or immigrants themselves. And so we're really dealing with a wide range in the community, and that includes ethnic and racial diversity, but also diversity of religious practice.
Well, we've got to take a quick break, but coming right up, I'll talk some more with the author of the new book, Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women, with Noura Masnavi, the author. And later in the show, why the overabundance of religious rhetoric may be, in the long run, good for our democracy. We can only hope. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. This free State of Belief Radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is Noura Masnavi, author of the new book, Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. I underlined a sentence on page 40. One contributor to the book writes this: "All of my life, I have possessed a dual, conflicted religious existence that is complicated socially accepted practices like dating, courtship, and boyfriends." Is this typical or is it exceptional?
I think one thing that's very clear from all of the contributors is that they do have very complex identities, and they're women, they're American Muslim women, they're wives, they're mothers, they're daughters. They live in different parts of the country, they have different professions, and it's really their sort of family story, we found, that sort of has made them who they are today. And the writer that you're quoting from is Nizla Mutman. She is an African-American Muslim woman who grew up in Oakland. And I think it really beautifully sort of talks about the ways in which her parents divorced when she was quite young, and the way in which they practiced their faith in very different ways led her to sort of this complicated identity as an adult. Mm-hmm. So she writes that her father was a very strict and practicing Muslim man. Her mother identified as a Muslim but wasn't as practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And that led her to sort of have different views on her faith and her identity. And she writes about sort of trying to come to terms with those as an adult.
Yeah. What is the sexual ethic in Islam? Does Islam insist on no sex before marriage and no sex outside of marriage? Or is there a sexual ethic?
So within Islam, there is a prohibition on sex outside of marriage, whether that be premarital sex or extramarital relations with somebody other than your partner, your spouse.
Mm-hmm.
For some women, that means that they don't have any types of relationships with men, even as friends.
Mm-hmm.
We have a story where one of our contributors writes about sort of the birds and the bees talk with her mother that comes about after her mother finds out she's going to the movies with one of her male friends.
Mm-hmm.
And for other women, that means that, you know, they had families where they were allowed to date, but there was an understanding that there would still be no sex.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the issue of premarital sex is something that that sort of underlies a lot of the stories, and that I think is because there is a very clear prohibition in Islam against premarital sex.
How would you answer the question, who or what is a good Muslim woman? And I'm also interested in, would I get different answers from different people when I ask that question?
Right. You know, for Aisha and I, when we started this project, it was very important for us to solicit stories from women who self-identified as Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there has been and there continues to be a discussion about what a real Muslim is, what a good Muslim woman looks like, and we really wanted to sort of take control of that discussion and say that a real Muslim is somebody who calls herself a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And that ultimately the relationship a woman has between her, there's a relationship that she has with God, is something very personal and
right.
something very private, and that from the outside, we have no concept of what that relationship looks like.
Yes.
And that faith is really not a linear path. Like, you know, you can be very close to God one day and far away the other, but what we have to have within the community is the space for people to come back to the community, to come
yeah.
back to faith. And that's what we really wanted to showcase in this book, that you have women who may not be practicing Islam in the way that you do,
mm-hmm.
But their identity and their relationship with God is not any less strong.
Right. In Islam, can sexual sins be forgiven? And let me say, I did read in more than one of the stories in the book of failures within a relationship that did not mean the end of that woman's venture into relationships. But I guess, is there a stigma of immorality if a sexual sin is exposed?
There is a concept within Islam that God forgives all sins except for the sin of shirk, which is associating others with God.
Mm-hmm.
But that God is, and I believe that God is a merciful and compassionate being that will forgive us all. And I think what we're dealing with in the book is more the sort of perception that women have, not necessarily with God, but within the community. And is there a stigma for women who, say, are divorced or who are sexually active?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really depends on a lot of factors. I think generally it is difficult. We have a section in the book of women who are writing about being married several times, being divorced and being remarried several times. And I think there is a stigma around divorce, but I also think that it really depends on the community. You know, there are women in our book who are coming from much more insular, ethnically homogenous communities where there's a lot of cultural traditions that are very powerful and that are very impactful in her lives. And there are other women who are coming from communities where issues of sexuality and divorce are spoken about much more openly.
I want to check a perception with you. The Muslim women whom I know are independent and opinionated like other women.
Right.
But the women in this book all seemed to struggle with their sexuality as if they had a sense that something might be wrong with them, even if everything else about it felt all right.
Right. That's very interesting that you say that. You know, when Aisha and I were collecting stories, we did a lot of outreach to the women that we know, women writers across the country. You know, we had over 200 submissions, but something that a lot of women told us was, this idea for a book is so great, but I could never contribute to the book because these are such personal and intimate details to share. And what we found is one of the receptions to the book has just been that the women in the book write so openly and honestly about their struggles with sexuality, with family issues, for example. And I think to a large degree that these are issues that a lot of women struggle with, and although it might not be something that they speak about openly, it's something, these sort of underlying thoughts and challenges are something that are quite universal to all women. So it's interesting, I think, even for a woman who might appear to be very opinionated and independent, I think if we were asked her to sort of talk openly about her love life or relationships or dating, that I do think that you would see that she's struggling with a lot of these issues as well.
I think you did all of us a service, not just members of the Muslim community, but members of all communities, and challenging us to think seriously about our own religious identity and sexuality as you have. The book is Love, Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. The first two printings have sold out, and the book reached number one on Amazon's Hot New Islam Releases chart. So congratulations to the book's author, Noura Masnavi, and your co-author. Noura is a civil rights attorney, writer, and Fulbright scholar. Noura, thank you for the book. Thank you for joining us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just ahead, Christian Piot on why the current prevalence of religious rhetoric in our politics may just be good for church-state separation in the long run. I'm anxious to hear this one. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. Christian Piot's blog describes him as a God nerd, and I'm pleased to welcome him now to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Christian, your article is provocatively titled, Rick Santorum, Champion of the Secular Left.
Yes.
Now, you'll have to bear with me here. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, it's obviously supposed to raise that question so people will read on. But I believe that the GOP establishment sees their greatest strength in arguing fiscal policy and economics against the Democrats. And the Santorum campaign is really shifting that debate to social issues such as birth control, gay rights, and things of that nature, where Democrats generally hold hold positions, and Barack Obama holds positions that are more popular in the mainstream culture. And the second case that I make for this is that when people see someone like Santorum saying that he is an advocate for greater faith in the public square, but then they hear the sorts of things that he is in support of, for example, that birth control goes against God's plan for creation, which is a largely unpopular view in mainstream America, that they say, well, if that's what faith in the public square is, then we don't want any part of it. So actually, in that way, he's actually driving momentum toward the both secularists, Jeffersonian Democrats, and progressives, I believe.
Well, one concern that many of us have is that this kind of campaigning is bad for religion overall, not just for religion and politics. Do you see a distinction here?
I think a lot of the positions that he takes are largely polarizing and fairly divisive, rather than synthetic and in search of common ground. It's basically standing on a platform of ideology and saying, love it or leave it. Rather than saying there are many common things about which we can agree, whether we're religious, whether we're not, whether we're Muslim, Jewish, agnostic, such as compassion, care for the poor, care for the elderly, and so forth, and building on those common grounds, it's just quite the opposite, and that's alienating to people. Plus, you see the thing, for example, on the front page of my paper here in Southern Colorado. There were people, you know, raising their hands and supplicating themselves and kneeling in prayer at one of his political rallies during the recent primaries. And I think, especially for people not familiar with the charismatic or more Pentecostal kind of church, that freaks them out.
Christian, ultimately, are you optimistic that religious language as a political strategy will fade away if, in fact, it proves to be as alienating as you project? Or are there too many true believers for whom it's not just a strategy, but a sincere conviction that faith should guide our politics?
I believe it's a small but vocal minority, to be honest with you. I think we have a greater opportunity to have a dialogue about the common social values that we share regardless of our religious background, and that when this is married to religion in particular, it tends to create a caricature or a stereotype that is that I think really speaks to his unelectability in the long term. I don't imagine someone that explicitly, religious and vocal about his very conservative and divisive agenda can sustain in the political forum. I don't believe he could even, go all the way to the nomination process, let alone against Obama.
Please talk a little bit about the book that you're working on.
I have a memoir coming out April 1st called Pregmancy, Pregmancy, about the changes that men, specifically myself, go through while their wives are pregnant and once they have a baby, because a lot of times we don't get to talk about what's going on with us. So,
Christian Piot is the creator and editor of Banned Questions About the Bible and Banned Questions About Jesus. His article, Rick Santorum, Champion of the Secular Left, can be found at patheos.com. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And one more thing.
Get out, leave right now. It's the end of-
as encouraging as Christian's perspective on the resilience of our constitutional first freedom is, we are not freed from identifying and responding to ongoing attempts to polarize the electorate in religious terms. And Rick Santorum reached what I believe to be a new low this past week. First of all, he was introduced at an event by an ultra-conservative pastor in Louisiana who got completely out of control in the introduction. He sounded more like he was for the war on religion and was leading the attack. He called on Americans who do not share his conservative Christian views to, quote, get out. As if that were not enough, here's what the candidate himself told a radio interviewer.
I think the bottom line is that we do well among people who take their faith seriously.
Well, I'd better keep this short before the smoke coming out of my ears sets off the fire alarms here at Argo Studios. A candidate who dares to not only hijack faith in the service to his own political ambitions, but who shares a stage with a preacher who calls for those who disagree with him on religious matters to leave the country, meaning your very right to be an American hinges on sharing a particular set of religious beliefs. A candidate who dares to equate support for his campaign with authenticity of religious convictions, how arrogant can you get? That's gravely misleading his supporters. At best, this kind of rhetoric diverts them from fully participating in our political process where their perspectives and voices are just as valid as anyone else's. Instead, he reduces our society to provincial fiefdoms of self-righteous and isolated factions based on an inaccurate interpretation of beliefs and values. At worst, it sets up an endless series of power shifts with the group that sees itself as virtuous dismissing entirely all other groups. Look, I'm not endorsing any one vision for this country, nor am I condemning any. But this dismissal of the fundamental, pluralistic, tolerant, and democratic soul of our nation has got to stop. I would no more want to live under an unyieldingly monolithic liberal model of America in which those who disagree are reviled, dehumanized, and dismissed than I would a conservative one. If we can't agree, as we have since our founding, on some basic ground rules for civil discourse, the damage done to both government and religion will be profound. And in no way will those gleefully riding the crest of this current wave be spared suffering from the fallout of that damage. As I've already hinted, they likely will be identified as part of the warriors attacking religion and undermining government. One of the great blessings of living in this nation is precisely the opportunity to interact every day with people who are very different from ourselves. This is also one of the great necessities for us to continue as a great nation. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices. Use them. You can listen to us anywhere, anytime. And that's something you'll definitely want to do. On next week's show, we're going to talk to the two faith leaders responsible for the following headline, Easter at the Mosque. I'll be in Louisiana to analyze the results of the GOP primary vote in my home state. And Easter weekend, a special extended conversation with legendary human rights pioneer, the Right Reverend Bishop Gene Robinson of New Hampshire. Share your thoughts, please, on what you've heard on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. You can become a member, and I want you to become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, politics, and virtually everything else. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what?